Chapter 59. As the train ran in past the great white mine dumps, and Sean leaned from the window of the coach to look ahead at the familiar skyline of Johannesburg, he wondered how such an unlovely city still had the power to draw him back each time. It was as though he was connected to it by an elastic umbilical cord, which allowed him a wide range, but when he reached its limit, it pulled him back. 2 days, he promised himself. 2 days I'll stay here, just long enough to hand old Aitchison my formal resignation and tell Candy goodbye. Then I'll head south to Ladyburg and leave this town to stew in its own evil juices. Near at hand, a midday hooter howled from one of the mines, and immediately its cry was taken up and answered by the other mines. It sounded as though a pack of hungry wolves were hunting across the valley, the wolves of greed and gold. Those mines that had been forced to close during the hostilities were now back in production, and the black smoke from their stacks sullied the sky and drifted in a dirty mist across the crest of the ridge. The train slowed, and the unexpected clatter and lurch of the points broke the rhythm of its run. Then it was sliding in along the concrete platform of Johannesburg Station. Sean lifted his luggage down from the rack above his head and passed it out of the open window to Imbijani. The exertion of lifting and carrying no longer caught in his guts, except for the irregular scar near his navel, he was completely healed. When he strode down the platform towards the exit, he held himself erect, no longer stooping to favour his stomach. A horse-drawn cab deposited them on the pavement outside Aitchison's headquarters, and Sean left Imbijani guarding the luggage, while he pushed his way across the crowded lobby and climbed the staircase to the first floor. "Good afternoon, Colonel." The orderly sergeant recognised him immediately and jumped to attention with such alacrity that he overturned his stool. "Good afternoon, Thompson," Sean told him. The honours of his rank still embarrassed him. Thompson relaxed and inquired with more than just the formal concern. "How are you, sir? Sorry to hear about your belly, sir." "Thank you, Thompson. I'm fine now. Is Major Peterson in?" Peterson was delighted to see him. He made tender inquiries after the movement of Sean's bowels, for irregularity was often one of the unpleasant aftermaths of a stomach wound. Sean reassured him, and Peterson went on. "Have some tea. The old man is busy right now, but he'll see you in 10 minutes. And he shouted for Thompson to bring tea before he returned to the subject of Sean's wound. "Much of a scar, old chap?" he asked. Sean loosened his Sam Brown belt, unbuttoned his tunic, and pulled his shirt out from his trousers. Peterson came round the desk and inspected Sean's hairy stomach at close range. "Very neat. Damn good job they did on you," Peterson gave his expert opinion. "I got one at Omdurman. One of those fuzzy-wuzzies pegged me with his dirty great spear." And he, in turn, partially disrobed and displayed his pale, hairless chest. From common courtesy, Sean was forced to cluck and shake his head at the small triangular cicatrice on Peterson's bosom, although secretly he was not impressed. The attention went to Peterson's head. "Got another one. Damn painful it was, too." And he unbuckled his belt and had his trousers half down when the interleading door opened. "Hope I'm not interrupting anything, gentlemen?" General Aitchison inquired politely. There were a few moments of confusion while they both attempted to dress and make the correct military salutations. Peterson had the nicest decision to make, one not covered by the Articles of War. It was one of the few occasions in history where a divisional commander was received by a senior field officer standing at rigid attention with his trousers round his ankles. Major Peterson affected a rather startling line in scarlet flannel underwear. Once Aitchison had understood the reason for this irregularity of dress among his officers, he was strongly tempted to join in the exhibition, for he also had some fine scars. But he restrained himself admirably. He led Sean through to the inner office and gave him a cigar. "Well, Courtney, I hope you haven't come looking for a job." "On the contrary, I want to get the hell out of this business, sir." "I think we can arrange that. The paymaster will be relieved," Aitchison nodded. "I'll get Peterson to draw up your papers." "I want to leave tomorrow," Sean insisted, and Aitchison smiled. "You're in a big hurry. All right. Peterson can post them to you for your signature. Your unit has already been disbanded, so there's no point in kicking your heels around here." "Good." Sean had anticipated resistance, and he laughed with relief. "There are just 3 other items," Aitchison went on, and Sean frowned with quick suspicion. "Oh? Firstly, a parting gift from His Majesty, a distinguished service order for catching LaRue. There will be an investiture next week. Lord Kay would like you to attend personally. Hell no, if I've got to stay in Johannesburg, I don't want it. And Aitchison chuckled. A surprising lack of gratitude. Peterson can post that to you also. Secondly, I've been able to bring a little influence to bear on the War Claims Adjustment Board. Although Parliament hasn't passed the bill, they've gone ahead and sanctioned your claim. Good God! Sean was stunned. At Aitchison's suggestion, he had registered a claim for £10,000, his deposit in the Volkskas Bank, which had been seized by the Boers at the outbreak of war. He had expected nothing from it, and had promptly forgotten about it. They haven't made a full award, have they? Oh, don't be naive, Courtney, Aitchison chuckled. Only 20%, against a possible further adjustment once the bill is through the House. Still, 2,000 is better than a poke in the eye with a blunt stick. Here's their cheque. You will have to sign for it. Sean examined the slip of paper with rising delight. It would go a little way towards paying off his loan from Natal Wattle. He looked up quickly. And the third item? He asked. Aitchison slipped a small square of cardboard across the desk. My card, and a standing invitation to visit and stay as long as you like whenever you are in London. He stood up and extended his hand. Good luck, Sean. And I'd like to think it isn't goodbye. In a rosy state of elation induced by freedom and the prospect of a loving farewell with Candy Rotenbach, Sean stopped the cab first at the railway station to reserve a seat on the following morning's southbound train and to cable Ada of his homecoming, then on to Commissioner Street and the lobby of Candy's hotel to ask for the proprietress. Mrs. Rotenbach is resting, sir, and cannot be disturbed, the clerk informed him. Good man, Sean passed him half a guinea and ignored his squawks of protest as he climbed the marble staircase. He let himself silently into Candy's suite and crossed to her bedroom. He wanted to surprise her, and there could be no doubt that he succeeded beyond his wildest expectations. Candy Rotenbach was not resting. In fact, she was most strenuously employed in the entertainment of a gentleman whose tunic, hanging over the back of one of the gilt and red velvet chairs, showed him to be a subaltern in one of His Majesty's regiments. Sean supported his subsequent actions on the hypothesis that Candy was his exclusive property. In the flood of righteous indignation that overwhelmed him, he took no account of the fact that his visit was a farewell gesture, that his relationship with Candy had been at best vague and intermittent, and that he was the following morning leaving to propose matrimony to somebody else. All he saw was the cuckoo in the nest. So that no discredit may reflect on the courage of the subaltern or the honour of his regiment, we must remember that his knowledge of Candy's domestic arrangements, if not those of her anatomy, was incomplete. She had been introduced to him as Mrs. Rotenbach, and now in this terrible moment, as he returned to reality, he assumed that the large and angry man who bore down on the bed, roaring like a wounded bull, was the one and only Mr. Rotenbach come home from the wars. He made preparation for departure, which began with a rapid descent from the high four-poster bed on the opposite side of that of Sean's approach. In a condition of stark mental clarity, induced by a superabundance of adrenaline in the bloodstream, the subaltern became aware of his own nudity, which prevented flight into the public gaze, of the fact that Mr. Rotenbach's threatening advance made such flight imperative, and finally that Mr. Rotenbach wore the uniform and insignia of a full colonel. This last consideration weighed most heavily with him, for despite his age, he came from an old and respected family with an impressive record of military service, and he understood the decencies and orders of society, of which one of the strictest was that you did not unite with the wife of an officer who outranked you. "Sir," he said, and drew himself up with dignity, "I think I can explain." "You little bugger," Sean answered him in a tone that suggested his explanation would have little consequence. Taking the shortest route, which was over the bed, Sean went for him. Candy, who had in these first few seconds been too preoccupied with pulling the coverlets over herself to take any active part in the proceedings, now shrieked and lifted the silk eiderdown in such a way that it wrapped around Sean's boots as he leapt over her and became tangled in his spurs. Sean fell with a crash that reverberated through the whole building and startled the guests in the lobby below, and he lay for the moment stunned, with his feet on the bed and his head and shoulders on the floor. "Get out!" Candy shouted at the subaltern, as Sean began to stir ominously. Then she gathered up an armful of bedclothes and spread them over Sean, winding him and smothering him. "Hurry up, for God's sake, hurry," she entreated, as her friend hopped with one leg in his breeches. "He'll tear you to pieces." And she pounced on top of the struggling, cursing mound of sheets and blankets. "Don't worry about the boots." And the subaltern tucked them under one arm, slung his tunic over his shoulders, and placed his helmet on the back of his head. "Thank you, ma'am," he said, and then with gallantry, "I sincerely regret any inconvenience I have caused you. Please give my apologies to your husband." "Get out, you fool," she pleaded, clinging desperately to Sean, as he heaved and swore. After he had left, she stood up and waited for Sean to emerge. "Where is he? I'll kill him. I'll murder the little bastard." Sean threw off the bedclothes, scrambled to his feet, and glared wildly around him. But the first thing he saw was Candy, and Candy was shaking with laughter. There was a lot of candy to shake, and most of it was white and round and smooth, and even if the laughter was a little hysterical, it was still a very pleasing spectacle. "Why did you stop me?" Sean demanded, but he was fast transferring his interest from the subaltern to Candy's bosom. "He thought you were my husband," she gasped. "The little bastard," growled Sean. "He was sweet," and abruptly she stopped laughing. "And who the hell are you to come barging in here anyway? Do you think you own the world and everything in it? You belong to me. Like hell I do," Candy exploded. "Now get out of here, you big lumbering ox." "Put some clothes on." Things were taking an unforeseen turn. Sean had expected her to be guilty and contrite. "Get out of here," she yelled, as her temper started to run. Sean had never seen her like this, and he only just managed to field the large vase she hurled at his head. Frustrated in her desire to hear breaking china, Candy grabbed another missile, an ornamental mirror, which crashed with satisfying violence against the wall behind him. Her boudoir was furnished in splendid Victorian taste and provided an almost unlimited supply of ammunition. Despite Sean's nimble footwork, he could not remain unscathed forever, and finally he was hit by a gilt-framed picture of some nameless officer. Candy's taste leaned rather heavily towards martial men. "You little bitch!" roared Sean in pain, and he launched a counter-attack. Candy fled, naked and squealing, but he caught her at the door, lifted her onto his shoulder, and carried her kicking to the bed. "Now, my girl," he grunted as he arranged her, pink bottom up, across his lap, "I'm going to teach you some manners." The first slap left a perfect red print of his hand upon her chubby cheeks and stilled her struggles. The second slap had considerably less force behind it, and the third was an affectionate pat, but Candy was sobbing pitifully. With his right hand raised, Sean realized with dismay that for the first time in his life he was striking a woman. "Candy," he spoke uncertainly, and was amazed that she twisted and sat up in his lap, clasped him about the neck, and pressed a damp cheek against him. Words welled up in his throat, words of apology, a plea for forgiveness. But his good sense prevented them from emerging, and instead he demanded huskily, Are you sorry for your behaviour?" Candy gulped and nodded shakily. "Please forgive me, darling. I deserved that." And her fingers fluttered at her throat and across his lips. "Please forgive me, Sean. I'm so terribly sorry." They ate dinner in bed that evening. In the early morning, while Sean soaked lazily in the sunken bath, and the hot water stung the scratches on his back, they talked. "I'm catching the morning train home, Candy. I want to be home for Christmas." "Oh, Sean, can't you stay just a few days?" "No." "When will you come back?" "I don't know." There was a long silence before she spoke again. "I take it then that I am not included in your plans for the future?" "You are my friend, Candy," he protested. "Now, isn't that nice?" And she stood up. "I'll order your breakfast." In the bedroom she paused and regarded herself slowly in the full-length mirror. The blue silk of her gown matched the blue of her eyes. But at this time of the day there were tiny creases in the skin of her throat. "I'm rich," she thought. "I don't have to be lonely." She walked on past the mirror.